this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the June 2010 edition of Ladies' Home Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Our article today is called The Private Life of Laura Bush. In this exclusive insert from her new memoir, Spoken from the Heart, First Lady, former First Lady, Laura Bush talks about her Texas childhood, her marriage, and her most trying days in the White House, and the twin daughters who make her so proud. On growing up in Midland, Texas, I was a homebody even as a child. My mother enrolled me in ballet, piano, dancing lessons, and brownies, but I was happiest at school or at home. The absence of brothers and sisters had another side. It cemented the deep bond between my parents and myself. We were a tightly knit unit of three. My parents took me to dinner, took me driving. Our lives intertwined, and I wanted to be with them. I felt my greatest sense of contentment lying on the couch in our den. I had no desire to stray too far from home or from Mother and Daddy. On being introduced to George W. Bush in 1977, when George and I met and then married after only 3 months, it was as if two parallel lives suddenly converged. Our childhood memories, the places we had known, even many of our friends overlapped. We were like the last two pieces of a puzzle, our similarities and contradictions sized to fit. George was boisterous and loved to talk, while I have always been quieter. And George came from a big family. It was an unexpected answer to my childish wishes on all those stars. On my side, George got to be the only son-in-law. But these layers of connections and commonalities forged a deeper, richer bond. We never worried that any long-buried fact about the other person would appear and surprise us. From the start, our marriage was built on a powerful foundation of trust. On her struggles with infertility, George and I had hoped that I would be pregnant by the end of his congressional run. Then we hoped it would be by the time his father announced his presidential run. Then by the presidential primaries, the convention, the general election. But each milestone came and went. The calendar advanced, and there was no baby. The English language lacks the words to mourn an absence. For the loss of a parent, a grandparent, spouse, child, or friend, we all have all sorts of words or manners or phrases that are helpful. Still, we are conditioned to say something, even if it's, "I'm sorry for your loss." But for an absence, for someone who was never there at all, we are wordless to capture that particular emptiness. For those who deeply want children or are denied them, those missing babies hover like silent shadows over their lives. Who can describe the feel of a tiny hand that might not ever be held? On the birth of Jenna and Barbara in 1981, Mrs. Bush underwent hormone treatments. I had always hoped I would have more babies, but I was 35 when the girls were born. The years unwound, and it didn't happen. George never once said that he wanted more children. He never once said that he would like a son. He was always thrilled with the two girls he got. We both are. But my heart was deep enough for more. There remained that twinge of what might have been. On George's drinking. George drank the three B's, a bourbon before dinner, a beer with dinner, and then B&B, a sweet drink after dinner. It was completely accepted because that, or some version of it, was the drinking life of most men. He didn't have three drinks every night. Many times, all he had was a beer. But when he poured enough, he could be a bore. Maybe it's funny when other people's husbands have too much to drink at a party. But I didn't think it was funny when mine did, and I told him so. But I never said the line, "It's either Jim Beam or me." That joke came much later. I was not going to leave George, and I wasn't going to let him leave me with our twins. Our marriage was enduring. We loved each other, and we were two people who did not have divorce in our DNA. But I was disappointed, and I let him know that I thought he could be a better man. On her relationship with her mother-in-law. When George and I married, I had planned on being more a daughter than a daughter-in-law. But Barbara Bush had five children of her own. She was their defender first. Our bond was that we both loved George, and the depth of our love was what we had in common. For the first 10 years, I saw her mostly during those harried Maine vacations when the onslaught of adult children, their spouses and companions, and then their children often drove her to distraction. She is only partially kidding when she says that when all else fails, follow the directions on the aspirin bottle. Take two and keep away from children. I look back now through albums at everyone grouped together, smiling gamely for the camera, and someone always looks as if they're about to cry. In a number of photos, the person on the verge of tears is Barbara. But from the start, she was ferociously tart-tongued, so I was a bit apprehensive about moving to Washington in 1987, where we would be living within walking distance of the senior Bushes. Yet away from that overflowing Maine summer house and high-profile political events, Barbara and I came to know and love each other. She still doesn't shy away from saying what she thinks. However, before George Sr. jumped out of an airplane on his 85th birthday in June 2009, Barbara noted that he had chosen to land on the lawn next to St. Anne's Church in Kennebunkport, just a few short rolls from his eternal resting place. On her life inside the White House, the daily hair blow dries are just one of the monetary costs of living in the White House. Most Americans may not realize that presidents and their families are responsible for their personal cost while they reside at Pennsylvania Avenue, and George and I paid for ours out of our own pocket. The presidential room, as if it were, is covered, but not the board. Presidents and their families are fortunately not responsible for the White House mortgage, but there were costs that I was not prepared for. I was amazed by the sheer number of designer clothes that I was expected to buy, like the women before me, meet the fashion expectations of a first lady. After our first year in the White House, our accountant said to George, "It costs a lot to be president," and he was referring to mainly my clothes. Sadly, pilfering was a common problem at the White House. Guests would walk out of the washrooms with hand towels stuffed in their jackets. One television personality was known for having a collection of White House paper hand towels, monogrammed with the presidential seal in her powder room. I was told that she had accumulated them when she came for interviews. Over the years, guests have removed pieces of flatware to the point where one set of silver engraved words with the words, "The President's House," was so popular as a souvenir that we only used it in the private dining room upstairs. Some visitors even took the cut glass pieces from the sconces that hung in the ladies' room on the ground floor. There were times when a social secretary staff joked that we should have guests walk through magnetometers on their way in and out. On September 11th, immediately after hearing the news, I called the girls, who had been whisked away by Secret Service agents to a secure location. In Austin, Jenna had been awakened by an agent pounding on her dorm door. In her room at Yale, Barbara had heard the sound of another student sobbing uncontrollably a few doors down. I tried to reach George, but my calls could not get through. George had tried to call me from Air Force One. It is stunning how to think that our state-of-the-art communications would not allow him to complete a phone call to Secret Service headquarters or me to reach him on Air Force One. On my second call from the secure line, our third attempt, I was finally able to contact the plane a little before 12 noon. I was grateful just to hear his voice and to tell him the girls were fine. From the way he spoke, I could hear how starkly his presidency had been transformed. On her husband's critics, It is easy to criticize a sitting president when you're not the one in the Oval Office, or when you do not have the ultimate responsibility for the decisions that must be made for the whole of nation. I thought of that when I heard the daily rants on the campaign trail. It got so even the weather seemed to be George's fault, and I wondered if Barack Obama, who spent far more time attacking George than he did his opponent, John McCain, would want to amend his words once he discovered the reality of the White House and was himself confronted by the challenges, crises that hit a president every day, all day. Presidents are not always right, but history tells us that our core values are right and that our country is good. Those are the values that guided George, the touchstone by which he measured what he did. George knew that in the heat of the moment, presidents tend to get much of the blame and little of the credit. Not all of his decisions would be popular, but as a nation, we would not want our president to make decisions solely on the basis of their own personal popularity, poll numbers, or daily headlines. The challenges we face are too great for that. I'm proud that as president, George acted on his principles, that he put our country first and himself last. A visit with Mrs. Bush. Not many people have the opportunity to step inside the house of a former president. So it was a thrill when Mrs. Bush invited Ladies Home Journal editor Sally Lee to her new home in Dallas. She was met at the door by Mrs. Bush and greeted by the former president, who was in workout gear, then invited into the cozy library for a long chat. Here is part of that interview. Sally Lee, how did you decide on the book's title? Laura's answer, well, the book really is spoken from the heart. It's candid, and I hope it reveals what I'm like and what my life was like. What will people be most surprised by? Bush. Probably my upbringing and the way my daddy was. Gambling and drinking was a strong part of West Texas culture. I don't know. What were you surprised by? Lee answers, I was surprised that I learned so much about your role as First Lady. Mrs. Bush said, I wanted to give people a sense of what life is like in the White House, even in mundane ways, like how you put on a state dinner. Those are the questions I get asked a lot, and they weren't really a part of the First Lady's memoirs that I read. The White House comes across as such a buttoned-up operation. Were you surprised by the recent party crashers incidents? Laura Bush. It was a shock when I saw it on the news, but I also think they were cons, unbelievable cons. Lee, you spent a lot of time as First Lady comforting people. Was that draining for you emotionally and spiritually? Laura Bush. It was especially difficult after September 11th. We had all these families that lost somebody, 3,000 deaths, multiplied by all those family members and friends. Trying to comfort people then was emotionally draining and anxiety-producing. And once our troops went into Afghanistan and then Iraq, I worried about that too. Not every First Lady has to serve when our nation is at war. Lee's next question, how afraid were you personally after the attacks on September 11th? I wasn't really afraid personally. Every precaution was taken to keep the president safe, so I benefited from that. But I was also a little fatalistic, thinking, if your number is up, it's up. I'm not a fearful person. It's not in my nature. Lee, you've raised two daughters to be humanitarians and public servants. Do you have any advice for parents about raising kids? We need to help children reach beyond themselves and to figure out ways they can help in their communities. When we give children the chance to look out at the world, it gives them a different perspective. They lead happier lives. You describe your husband as deeply sentimental. How does that play out in your family life? I remember at our wedding, when he stood up to give the toast, he started to weep. He did the same thing when Jenna got married. He started walking her down the aisle, and the whole way he was weeping. Do you have any advice for Mrs. Obama on how to deal with the public criticism of her husband? No, the criticism is so extreme, they end up being characterized in a way that they're not at all. And we knew that. When George's dad was president, it was very hard for us to tolerate. It's too bad because I think it discourages people from even considering careers in politics. The last question, how has it been for you transitioning from public to private life? At the end of the book, I write about the buoyancy of freedom I felt when I left Washington. I was literally almost physical. I felt like I could stand up straighter. I didn't have to deal with all that stress and pressure. The next excerpt from the book, like mother, like daughters, the Bush twins, now 28, have made doing good a top priority. Jenna Bush Hager, school teacher, correspondent for the Today Show, and author of Anna's Story, about a girl living with HIV. My mom raised us to do the things we love, but also to be conscious of what's going on in the world. When I was in high school, she encouraged me to work at the Autism Children's Shelter. I ended up working there for 2 years, spending my Sundays with kids. We also talked about HIV and AIDS a lot as a family. As a result, both Barbara and I have become HIV/AIDS activists. Our parents taught us that it's our responsibility to give as much as we can. Here's from Barbara Bush, the second daughter. President of Global Health Corps, which gives fellowships to recent graduates and professionals under the age of 30 so they can work with organizations in developing countries around the world. When I was a junior at Yale, I took a course called AIDS in Society. That summer, when my parents traveled to Africa, I went along. We were lucky that our parents allowed us to tag along with them on any trip we thought was interesting. Because of that, we were exposed to many fields. It helped us choose what we wanted to do with our lives. Now, with Global Health Corps, our mission is to engage the next generation of leaders. Slow down. It may sound just like a fad, but the slow movement's got some serious science behind it. Taking it easy not only helps you beat stress, but it also improves your marriage, your bank account, even your weight. I never realized quite how fast my life moved until I went on vacation last year and slammed on the brakes. Instead of taking one of our usual family sightseeing trips where we spend our day checking landmarks off our list, we rented a cabin tucked deep in the Adirondack Woods. For one blissful week, my days, usually an overscheduled blur of work, chores, and ringing gadgets, involved not much more than listening to the birds chirp. And a strange thing began to happen. As one delightfully languid moment passed into the next, I started to feel as if I was waking up. I felt engaged, present, and energized in a way I had forgotten I could be. Back at home, I've tried to recapture some of that focus by reprogramming my speed addict habits and have been amazed to find that I'm actually more productive and less stressed out. The idea that a more relaxed approach to life can be good for you isn't just my personal post-vacation epiphany. It's actually the basis of a new movement that encourages us all to put on the brakes a bit more. The thinking, finding a slower rhythm can improve just about every part of your life and health. Slow walking. Most of the time, you walk with a destination in mind and urge to get there as fast as possible. You hurry, head down, eyes anxiously scanning the phone for messages, fingers frantically typing a text, completely oblivious to your surroundings. But walking slowly, ambling, strolling, whether you're going somewhere or nowhere, is a whole different experience. Slow walking, no iPods or cell phones allowed, isn't a workout. It's an exercise only in observation, a way to look at the places and people around you as a small child might, with curiosity and wonder. Walking engages your visual senses, allowing you to look at things and really see them, says Willard Spiegelman, author of Seven Pleasures, Essays on Ordinary Happiness. The pleasure of walking the same route each day is that you register subtle changes, the way the leaves turn, fall, bud again, how a building is demolished, then rebuilt. When you walk slowly, you also go over the day. Make lists. Think about what you might have said to someone, what you still might say. It composes and clears your mind. Does it matter where you take these soothing strolls? Spiegelman says he favors opposite extremes, busy city streets pulsating with life, or quiet lanes where natural beauty abounds. But the truth is, slow walking can work its magic anywhere. If there doesn't seem to be much to look at, look harder, he says. Walking opens up the world to you. Slow conversation. Having a conversation isn't the same as having a talk. Talk involves exchanging specific information and instructions, getting to the point. Conversations has a different purpose, says essayist Stephen Miller, the author of Conversation, A Declining Art. It's not about what somebody wants done or needs to know. It doesn't have to be direct. It can be a circle. It can digress. The point is for two people to connect. We've all experienced the joy of slow conversation, the marathon coffee talks with a friend we've known since childhood, the getting-to-know-you whispers of early love. It's easy to let it fall by the wayside in the rush of daily life, but without it, friendship, even marriage, begins to wither. Bringing true conversation back into your life means making time and space for it. You can't have a slow conversation by email. The phone's an option when distance is a factor. The best opportunity for real conversation is when two people are physically together, with no time limit and no cell phones in sight. It could be a three-hour dinner with a friend or a long car trip with a spouse. In the fullness of that kind of unstructured time, talks can meander among memories of the past, plans for the future, and everything in between. That's when you get the full plate of interaction, gestures, tones, facial expressions. You go away feeling completely connected. Slow eating. There's a practical reason why you shouldn't bolt down your food. It takes about 20 minutes for your stomach to signal to your brain that you've had enough, says Kim Gorman, director of weight management. If you eat slowly, you're less likely to overeat. But that's not the whole story. Slow Food USA, an organization that has 225 chapters nationwide, says you'll eat better and healthier, but also with considerably more pleasure if the mealtime means more than just rushing out for fast food and gulping it down. Slow eating also means that knowing where your food comes from, taking time to prepare it, and cook the meals with your family, even if it's just once or twice a week. There's something special about being with people you love in a good-smelling kitchen, says Josh Vertel, the group's president. It creates memories and makes everyone appreciate the meal more. When you spend a half hour shelling peas, you notice how they taste. What else helps you appreciate your food? Buy locally when possible, so you can enjoy fresh flavors and textures and sit down to eat together as a family, a way to fill up your soul as well as your stomach. Slow spending. The formula for fast spending is simple. See something? Want it? Buy it. Before the recent recession, it was how many Americans lived. And while the current cash flow crunch certainly has its drawbacks, it may help you to remember the pleasures of a slow, mindful way. Slow spending means actively resisting the impulse to whip out your credit card every time you see something you like. Instead, discipline yourself to hold on to your cash while considering why you want it. Do you really need those new wedge sandals or that flat screen TV? Or are you at a monetary rush, a way to keep up with your neighbors? You have to ask yourself hard questions. Can I truly afford what I want to buy? Will I use it? Is it of value to me? And is buying it consistent with my values? If the answer to any of these questions is no, walk away. how to cut buying without feeling deprived, measure spending against your life's goals and deepest desires. It's what's most important to you is to travel or retire early or give more to your church. Curbing your spending will help you achieve those things. The benefits of slow spending range from getting out of debt to teaching your children the value of limits. You also have the satisfaction of knowing you're putting less junk in the local landfill, since a lot of impulse buys wind up there. The great gift is that those things can also make you feel good. Ironically, sometimes the less you spend, the happier you are. Slow parenting. Today's family homes often resemble a high-pressure workplace driven by deadlines and to-do lists. Carol Ornray, author of In Praise of Slowness, is convinced that chilling out offers a better and more enjoyable way to raise kids. Slow parenting is about understanding that you don't do things as fast as possible. It means giving children the time and space to explore the world and keeping the family schedule under control so there's enough time for you just to be together. But another way, it means getting more out of doing less. Slow parenting doesn't require any fancy equipment. Actually, the less techno gear, the better. Start by clearing the calendar so there's an afternoon that doesn't include soccer practice, piano lessons, or errands. Turn off phones and computers and take your watch. Then break out a board game or go outside, read a book out loud, or head outdoors to explore your own backyard. Maybe you'll see a bird's nest and watch until the mother returns. Or perhaps your daughter will spot a ladybug in the rose bush. She'll stop, look, give it a name, invent a story for it. And if you don't have to break the spell by rushing off to ballet class, the next 15 minutes will be a delight. The impromptu times in which parents and children share this kind of wonder at the world around them produce a type of closeness that couldn't be planned even if you tried. These timeless, simple rituals have brought people together for thousands of years, and they still do. Slow hobbies. No one can knit a scarf or sweater overnight. It takes thousands of stitches, and the moments when you only hear the clicking of the needles. Trying to hurry the process just makes mistakes. That's not the frustration of knitting. That's the point. Slow hobbies, knitting, quilting, embroidery, woodwork, require patience and deliberation. In return, they calm you, putting you in a contemplated zone. That's a kind of therapy. The rhythmic, repetitive movements of a hobby like knitting are soothing and distracting. They seem to lull people. Catherine Applegate of Duke University advises patients struggling to lose weight to take up sewing and other hands-on crafts to combat stress, which can lead to overeating. Some teachers report that knitting during class calms and focuses kids with ADHD. Even doing a jigsaw puzzle can help. The slow work of a hands-on hobby creates a pace that can soothe the soul. So a few points to remember. What's the rush? An easy stroll is a much more soothing way to get there. Emails may be easy, but a phone call to a friend makes your relationship stronger. Dieting pounds drop gradually, they will stay off longer. Well, we've run out of time for today's issue of From Soups to Nuts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long, until next time.